idea. What do I tell this poor woman? Wally picked up his legal pad. I talked to her an hour ago. Name's Pauline Sutton, age 62. Her 40-year-old son, Jermaine, died of a heart attack 7 months ago. Said he was a bit on the heavy side. Took Crayox for 4 years to lower his cholesterol. A charming lady, but also a grieving mother. Take one of our brand new Crayox contracts for legal services, explain it to her, sign her up. Piece of cake. What if she has questions about the lawsuit and settlement? Make an appointment and get her in here. I'll answer her questions. What's important is getting her signed up. We've created a hornet's nest here in Chicago. Every half-assed ambulance chaser in the business is now loose on the streets looking for Crayox victims. Time is of the essence. Can you do it, Miss Gibson?
I suppose. Thank you so much. Now I suggest we all hit the streets.
Their first stop was an all-you-can-eat pizza house not far from the office. The restaurant was owned by a chain, a somewhat infamous company that was suffering through a firestorm of bad press caused entirely by its menu. The leading health magazine had analyzed its food and declared it all hazardous and unfit for human consumption. Everything was drenched with grease, oils, and additives, and no effort was made to cook anything even remotely healthy. Once the food was ready, it was served buffet-style and offered at ridiculously low prices. The chain had become synonymous with hordes of morbidly obese people feeding at its buffet troughs. Profits were soaring. The assistant manager was a plump young man named Adam Grand, and he asked them to wait 10 minutes before he could take a break. David and Wally found a booth as far away from the buffet tables as possible, which wasn't far at all. The booth was roomy and wide, and David realized that everything in the place was oversized. Plates, glasses, napkins, tables, chairs, booths. Wally was on his cell phone, eagerly lining up another meeting with a potential client. David could not help but watch the enormous people digging through piles of thick pizza. He almost felt sorry for them. Adam Grand slid in beside David and said, "You got 5 minutes? My boss is yelling back there." Wally wasted no time. "You told me on the phone that your mother died 6 months ago, heart attack. She was 66 and took Crayox for a couple of years. How about your father?"
"Died 3 years ago."
"Sorry, Crayox, perhaps?"
"No, colon cancer."
"Brothers, sisters?"
"One brother who lives in Peru. He will not be involved in any of this."
David and Wally were scribbling away. David felt as though he should say something important, but had nothing on his mind. He was there as the chauffeur. Wally was about to ask another question when Adam threw a curveball.
"Say, I just talked to another lawyer."
Wally's spine straightened, his eyes widened.
"Oh, really? What's his name?"
"He said he was a Crayox expert and he could get us $1 million, no sweat. Is that true?" Wally was ready for combat.
"He's lying. If he promised you $1 million, then he's an idiot. We can't promise anything in the way of money. What we can promise is that we'll provide the best legal representation you can find."
"Sure, sure, but I like the idea of a lawyer telling me how much I might get. Know what I mean?"
"We can get you a lot more than $1 million, Wally promised.
"Now we're talking. How long will this take?"
"A year, maybe two,"
Wally promised again. He was sliding across a contract.
"Look this over. It's a contract between our firm and you as the legal representative of your mother's estate."
Adam scanned it quickly and said,
"Nothing up front, right?"
"Oh no, we front the litigation expenses.
40% for you guys is pretty steep."
Wally was shaking his head.
"That's the industry average.
All standard. Any lawyer doing mass torts who's worth his salt is getting 40%. Some want 50, but not us. I think 50's unethical." He looked at David for confirmation, and David nodded and frowned at the thought of those shady lawyers out there who possessed questionable ethics.
"I guess so," Adam said, then signed his name.
Wally snatched the contract and said,
"Great, Adam, good move, and welcome aboard. We'll add this case to our lawsuit and kick things into high gear. Any questions?"
"Yeah, what should I tell this other lawyer?"
"Tell him you went with the best, Finley and Fig."
"You're in good hands, Adam," David said solemnly, and immediately realized he sounded like a bad commercial. Wally shot him a look that said, "Seriously?"
"I guess that remains to be seen, doesn't it?" Adam said. "We'll know when the big check gets here. You promised more than $1 million, Mr. Fig, and I take you at your word. You won't be sorry."
"See you," Adam said and disappeared. Wally was stuffing his legal pad into his briefcase when he said, "That was easy. You just guaranteed the guy something over $1 million. Is that wise?"
"No, but if that's what it takes, then that's what it takes. Here's how it works, young David. You sign him up, get him on board, keep him happy, and when there's money on the table, they'll forget about what you said up front. Say, for example, a year from now, Varric gets sick of its Crayox mess and throws in the towel. Let's say our new pal Adam here is due less than $1 million. Pick a number, $750,000. Now, do you really believe that loser will walk away from that much money?
Probably not.
Exactly. He'll be one happy boy and he'll forget about anything we said today. That's how it works."
Wally took a long, hungry look at the buffet bars.
"Say, you got plans for dinner? I'm starving."
David had no plans, but he would not be eating there.
"Yeah, my wife's waiting for a late snack."
Wally looked again at the troughs and the hulking masses of people grazing there. He froze for a second, then cracked a smile.
"What a great idea," he said, complimenting himself.
"I'm sorry?
Look at those people. What's the average weight?"
"I have no idea."
"Neither do I, but if I'm a bit pudgy at 240, those folks are well over 400 pounds.
You're losing me, Wally."
"Look at the obvious, David. This place is packed with grossly overweight people, half of whom are probably on Crayox. I'll bet if I yelled right now, 'Who's on Crayox?' half of these poor bastards would raise their hands."
"Don't do that."
"I'm not, but don't you see my point?
You want to start handing out cards?"
"No, smartass, but there must be a way to screen these people for Crayox users."
"But they're not dead yet."
"It won't be long.
Look, we can add them to our second lawsuit of non-death cases."
"I'm missing something here, Wally. Help me. Aren't we required to prove at some point that the drug actually causes some type of damage?"
"Sure, and we'll prove it later when we hire our experts. Right now, the important thing is to get everybody signed up. It's a horse race out there, David. We got to figure out a way to screen these folks and sign them up." 6 o'clock was approaching and the restaurant was packed. David and Wally had the only booth not being used for dinner. A large family of four approached, each holding two platters of pizza. They stopped at the booth and cast menacing looks at the two lawyers. This was serious business. Their next stop was a duplex in a neighborhood near Midway Airport. David parked at the curb behind an ancient Volkswagen Beetle on blocks. While he was saying, "Frank Schmidt, age 52, when he succumbed last year to massive stroke. I spoke with his widow, Agnes." But David was only half listening. He was trying to convince himself that he was really doing this, scrambling around the rough spots of Chicago's southwest side with his new boss, who couldn't drive because of problems, after dark, on the lookout for street thugs, knocking on strange doors of untidy homes, not knowing what was inside, all in an effort to hustle clients before the next lawyer came along. What would his friends from Harvard Law think about it? How hard would they laugh? But David decided he really didn't care. Any law job was better than his old one, and most of his friends from law school were miserable. He, on the other hand, had been liberated. Agnes Schmidt was either hiding or not at home. No one came to the door, and the two lawyers hurried away. As he drove, David said, "Look, Wally, I really would like to get home and see my wife. I haven't seen her much in the past 5 years. Time to catch up."
"She's very cute. I don't blame you."
Chapter 14. Within a week of filing its lawsuit, the firm had a total of 8 death cases, a respectable number and one that would certainly make them rich. Because Wally said it so often, it had become the accepted belief that each case meant roughly $500,000 in net fees to Finley and Fig. His math was shaky and riddled with assumptions that had little basis in reality, at least at such a preliminary stage of the litigation. But the three lawyers and Rochelle began to think in terms of that kind of money. Crayox was making news around the country, none of it positive, and its future looked ominous, as far as Varric Labs was concerned. The firm had worked so hard to get the cases, it was a shock to realize they could actually lose one. Millie Marino arrived at the office one morning in a foul mood and demanded to see Mr. Fig. She had hired him to probate her husband's estate, and then she had reluctantly agreed to pursue a Crayox claim for his death. In Wally's office, behind closed doors, she explained she could not resolve the fact that one lawyer in the firm, Oscar, had prepared a will that kept a sizable asset, the baseball card collection, out of her reach, and now the other lawyer, Wally, was probating that same will. This, in her opinion, was a glaring conflict of interest and downright sleazy to boot. She was upset and began crying. Wally tried to explain that lawyers are bound by rules of confidentiality. When Oscar prepared the will, he had to do what Chester wanted, and since Chester wanted his baseball cards hidden until after his death, then given to his son Lyle, so be it. Ethically, Oscar could not divulge any information to anyone about Chester and his will. Millie didn't see it that way. As his wife, she had a right to know about all of his assets, especially something as valuable as his cards. She had already talked to a dealer, and the Shoeless Joe card alone was worth at least $100,000. The entire collection might fetch $150,000. Wally really didn't give a damn about the baseball cards or the estate, for that matter. The $5,000 fee he had once contemplated was now peanuts. He had a Crayox case on the line here, and he would say or do anything to keep it. "Frankly," he said gravely as he glanced at his door, "between the two of us, I would have handled it differently, but Mr. Finley comes from the old school." "Meaning what?" she asked. "He's pretty chauvinistic. The husband is the head of the house, keeper of all assets, the only decision maker, you know the type. If the man wants to hide things from his wife, nothing wrong with that. Me, I'm much more liberated." He followed this with a nervous laugh that was confusing. "But it's too late," she said. "The will has been written. Now it's going to probate." "True, Millie, but things will work out. Your husband left his baseball cards to his son, but he left you with a beautiful lawsuit."
"A beautiful what?"
"You know, the Crayox thing."
"Oh, that.
Yes, I'm not too happy with that either. I've talked to another lawyer, and he says you're in over your head, says you've never handled a case like this." Wally gasped for air, then managed to ask in a squeaky voice, "Why are you talking to other lawyers?"
"Because he called me the other night. I checked him out online. He's in a big firm with offices all over the country, and all they do is sue drug companies. I'm thinking about hiring him."
"Don't do that, Millie. These guys are famous for signing up 1,000 cases, then screwing their clients. You'll never talk to him again, just some young paralegal in the back room. It's a scam, I swear it is. You can always get me on the phone."
"I don't want to talk to you on the phone or in person either."
She was on her feet, gathering her handbag.
"Please, Millie. I'll think about it, Fig, but I'm not happy."
10 minutes after she left, Iris Klopek called and asked to borrow $5,000 against her portion of the Crayox settlement. Wally sat at his desk with his head in his hands and wondered what might happen next. Wally's lawsuit was assigned to the Honorable Harry Seawright, a Reagan appointee who had been on the federal bench for almost 30 years. He was 81, anticipating retirement, and not too excited about a lawsuit that could take a few years to resolve and eat up his calendar in the process. But he was curious. His favorite nephew had been taking Crayox for several years, with great success, and no side effects at all. Not surprisingly, Judge Seawright had never heard of the law firm of Finley and Fig. He directed his law clerk to check out the firm, and the clerk's email read, "A two-man ham-and-egg operation on Preston, Southwest Side. Advertises for quickie divorces, DUIs, usual criminal domestic injury practice. No record of any filings in federal court in the past 10 years. No record of jury trials in state court in past 10 years. No bar association activity. They do occasionally go to court. Fig has either 2 or 3 DUIs in past 12 years. Firm was once sued for sexual harassment. Settled." Seawright was incredulous. He emailed his clerk, "These guys have no trial experience, yet they filed a $100 million lawsuit against the third largest pharmaceutical company in the world?" The clerk responded, "Correct." Judge Seawright, "Insane. What's behind this?" The clerk, "Crayox Stampede. It's the latest and hottest bad drug in the country. Mass tort bar is in frenzy. Finley and Fig probably hopes to ride coattails all the way to a settlement." Judge Seawright, "Keep digging." Later, the clerk responded, "The lawsuit is signed by Finley and Fig, but also a third lawyer, David E. Zink, former associate at Rogan Rothberg. I called a friend there, said Zink cracked up, bolted 10 days ago, somehow landed out there at FF. No litigation experience. Guess he found the right place." Judge Seawright, "Let's watch this case closely."
the clerk. As always.
Varick Labs was headquartered in a baffling series of glass and steel buildings in a forest near Montville, New Jersey. The complex was the work of a once-famous architect who had since repudiated his own design. It was occasionally praised as daring and futuristic, but much more often it was denounced as drab, hideous, bunker-like, Soviet-style, and a lot of other unkind words. In several ways, it resembled a fortress surrounded by trees away from the traffic and crowds, protected. Because Varick got sued so often, its headquarters seemed fitting. The company was hunkered down out there in the woods, braced for the next assault. Its CEO was Reuben Massey, a company man who had led Varick for many years through turbulent times and also to impressive profits. Varick was in a constant state of war with the Mass Tort Bar, and while other pharmaceuticals wilted or folded under waves of litigation, Massey managed to keep his stockholders happy. He knew when to fight, when to settle cheap, and how to appeal to the lawyer's greed while saving his company tons of money. During his term, Varick had survived, one, a $400 million settlement for a denture cream that caused zinc poisoning, two, a $450 million settlement for a stool softener that backfired and clogged things up, three, a $700 million settlement for a blood thinner that cooked a bunch of livers, four, a $1.2 billion settlement for a migraine remedy that allegedly caused high blood pressure, five, a $2.2 billion settlement for a high blood pressure pill that allegedly caused migraines, six, a $2.3 billion settlement for a painkiller that was instantly addictive, and, worst of all, seven, a $3 billion settlement for a diet pill that caused blindness. It was a long, sad list, and Varick Labs had paid dearly in the court of public opinion. Reuben Massey, though, continually reminded his troops of the hundreds of innovative and effective drugs they created and sold to the world. What he did not talk about, except in the boardroom, was the fact that Varick had profited from every drug that had been targeted by the plaintiff's lawyers. So far, the company had won the battle, even after forking over huge settlements. Crayax, however, could be different. There were now four lawsuits, the first one in Fort Lauderdale, the second in Chicago, and now two new ones in Texas and Brooklyn. Massey closely monitored the workings and dealings of the Mass Tort Bar. He spent time each day with his in-house lawyers studying the lawsuits, reading the bar journals and newsletters and blogs, and talking to his lawyers in big firms across the country. One of the most revealing signals in any looming war was TV advertising. When the lawyers began bombarding the airwaves with their sleazy get-rich-quick come-ons, Massey knew Varick was in for another expensive brawl. Crayox ads were popping up everywhere. The frenzy had begun. Massey had worried about a few of Varick's other targets. The migraine pill was a huge blunder, and he still cursed himself for ramming it through research and approvals. The blood thinner almost got him fired, but he had never doubted Crayox, nor would he ever. Varick had spent $4 billion developing the drug. It had been tested extensively in clinical trials in third world countries. The results had been spectacular. Its research was thorough and immaculate. Its pedigree was flawless. Crayox caused no more strokes and heart attacks than the daily vitamin pill, and Varick had a mountain of research to prove it. The daily legal briefing was held at precisely 9:30 in the Varick boardroom on the fifth floor of a building that resembled a Kansas wheat silo. Reuben Massey was a stickler for punctuality, and his eight in-house lawyers were in their seats by 9:15. The team was led by Nicholas Walker, a former U.S. attorney, former Wall Street litigator, and the current mastermind behind every defense Varick erected to protect itself. When the lawsuits began dropping like cluster bombs, Walker and Reuben Massey spent hours together, coolly responding, analyzing, scheming, and directing counterattacks when necessary. Massey entered the room at 9:25, picked up an agenda, and said, "What's the latest?" "Crayox or Faladin?" Walker asked. "Gee, I almost forgot about Faladin. Let's stick to Crayox for the moment." Faladin was an anti-wrinkle cream that was allegedly causing wrinkles, according to a few loudmouth lawyers on the West Coast. The litigation had yet to gain momentum, primarily because the lawyers were finding it difficult to measure wrinkleness before and after. Nicholas Walker said, "Well, the gates are open. Snowballs rolling down the mountain. Pick your metaphor. All hell's breaking loose. I chatted with Alessandro's at Zellin Potter yesterday, and they're getting flooded with new cases. He plans to push hard to establish multi-district in Florida and keep his finger on things." "Alessandro's. Why do the same thieves show up at every heist?" Massey asked. "Haven't we paid them enough over the past 20 years? "Evidently not. He's built his own golf course for Zellin Potter lawyers only and a few lucky friends, and he invited me to come down and play. 18 holes. Please go, Nick. We need to see how wisely our money is being invested by these thugs." "Will do. I got a phone call late yesterday afternoon from Amanda Petricelli in Reno. Says she's hooked her a few death clients, putting together a class, and will file suit either today or tomorrow. I told her it really didn't matter to us when she filed suit. We can expect more filings this week and next."
"Crayox is not causing strokes and heart attacks," Massey said. "I believe in this drug." The 8 lawyers nodded their heads in agreement. Reuben Massey was not one to make bold statements or false claims. He had doubts about Faladin, and Varick would eventually settle for a few million long before a trial. Number 2 on the legal team was a woman named Judy Beck, another veteran of the mass tort wars. She said, "All of us feel the same, Reuben. Our research is better than theirs, if they actually have any. Our experts are better. Our proof is better. Our lawyers will be better. Perhaps it's time we counterattack and throw everything we have at the enemy." "My thoughts exactly, Judy," Massey said. "You guys have a strategy?" Nicholas Walker said, "It's evolving, but for now, we go through the same motions, make the same public comments, watch and wait, and see who files what and where. We look at the lawsuits, study the judges and the jurisdictions, and we pick our spot. When the stars are all aligned, the right plaintiff, the right city, the right judge, then we hire the hottest gunslinger in town and push hard for a trial." "This has backfired, you know," Massey said.
"Don't forget Clervex.
That cost us $2 billion.
Their miracle blood pressure pill was destined for greatness until thousands of its users developed horrific migraines. They, Massey and the lawyers, believed in the drug and rolled the dice with the first jury trial, which they fully expected to win in a slam dunk. An overwhelming victory would dampen the tort bar's enthusiasm and save Varick a ton of money. The jury, though, felt otherwise and gave the plaintiff $20 million.
"This is not Clervex," Walker said.
"Crayox is a much better drug, and the lawsuits are much weaker."
"I agree," Massey said. "I like your plan." Chapter 15. At least twice a year, and more often if possible, the Honorable Anderson Zink and his lovely wife Carolyn drove from their home in St. Paul to Chicago to see their only son and his lovely wife Helen. Judge Zink was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Minnesota, a position he had been honored to hold for 14 years. Carolyn Zink taught art and photography at a private school in St. Paul. Their 2 younger daughters were still in college. Judge Zink's father and David's grandfather was a legend named Woodrow Zink, who at the age of 82 was still hard at work managing the 200-lawyer firm he'd founded 50 years earlier in Kansas City. The Zinks had deep roots in that city, but not deep enough to keep Anderson Zink and his son from fleeing the harshness of working for old Woodrow. They wanted no part of his firm and left Kansas City, and this had caused a rift that was just beginning to mend. Another rift was brewing. Judge Zink did not understand his son's sudden career change and wanted to get to the bottom of it. He and Carolyn arrived in time for a late lunch on Saturday afternoon and were pleasantly surprised to see their son at home. He was usually at the office, downtown in a tall building. On a visit the previous year, they had never actually laid eyes on him. He came home after midnight on a Saturday, then left to return to the office 5 hours later. Today, though, he was on a ladder cleaning the gutters. He jumped down and hurried to greet them. "You look great, Mom," he said as he lifted her up and spun her around. "Put me down," she said. David shook hands with his father, but there was no hug. The Zink men did not hug each other. Helen appeared from the garage and greeted her in-laws. She and David were both grinning goofily about something. He finally said, "We have some big news." "I'm pregnant," Helen blurted. "You 2 geezers are about to be grandparents," David said. Judge and Mrs. Zink took the news well. They were, after all, in their late 50s, and many of their friends were already grandparents. Helen was 33, 2 years older than David, and, well, it was certainly about time, wasn't it? They digested this amazing news, rallied nicely, then offered congratulations and wanted details. Helen gabbed away as David unloaded their luggage and everyone moved inside. Over lunch, the baby talk eventually subsided and Judge Zink finally got down to business. "Tell me about your new firm, David," he said. David knew damn well his father had dug and dug and found what little there was to know about Finley and Fig. "Oh, Andy, don't start that," Carolyn said, as if that were a raw subject that should be avoided. Carolyn agreed with her husband and believed David had made a serious mistake, but the news of Helen's pregnancy had changed everything, for the future grandmother anyway. "I told you on the phone," David said quickly, anxious to have this discussion and get it over with. He was also prepared to defend himself, to fight, if necessary. His father chose a career that was not what old Woodrow wanted. David had now done the same. "It's a small two-man firm with a general practice, 50 hours a week, which gives me time to fool around with my wife and keep the family name going. You should be proud."
"I'm delighted Helen is expecting, but I'm not sure I understand your decision. Rogan Rothberg is one of the most prestigious law firms in the world. They've trained judges, legal scholars, diplomats, and leaders of business and government. How can you just walk away from that?"
"I didn't walk away, Dad. I ran. And I'm not going back.
I hate the memories of Rogan Rothberg, and I think even less of the people." They were eating as they spoke. Things were cordial. Andy had promised Carolyn he would not provoke a fight. David had promised Helen he would not engage in one.
"So this new firm has two partners?" the judge asked. "Two partners and now three lawyers, plus Rochelle, the secretary, receptionist, office manager, and a lot of other things. Support staff, clerks, paralegals, interns. Rochelle handles all that. It's a small firm where we do most of our own typing and research."
"He's actually home for dinner," Helen added. "I've never seen him so happy."
"You look great," Carolyn said, "both of you."
The judge was not accustomed to being outnumbered or outflanked.
"These two partners, are they trial lawyers?"
"They claim to be, but I have my doubts. They're basically a couple of ambulance chasers who advertise a lot and survive on car wrecks."
"What made you choose them?"
David glanced at Helen, who looked away with a smile.
"That, Dad, is a long story that I will not bore you with."
"Oh, it's not boring," Helen said, barely suppressing laughter.
"What kind of money do they make?" the judge asked.
"I've been there 3 weeks. They have not shown me the books, but they're not getting rich. And I'm sure you want to know how much I'm making." "Same answer. I don't know. I get a piece of what I bring in the door, and I have no idea what might walk in tomorrow."
"And you're starting a family?"
"Yes, and I'll be home for dinner with my family and T-ball and Cub Scouts and school plays and all the other wonderful stuff parents are supposed to do with their kids."
"I was there, David. I missed very little."
"Yes, you were, but you never worked for a sweatshop like Rogan Rothberg."
A pause as everybody took a breath. David said,
"We saved a lot. We'll survive nicely. Just wait and see."
"I'm sure you will," his mother said, switching sides completely, and now fully aligned against her husband.
"I haven't started the nursery yet," Helen said to Carolyn. "If you'd like, we can go to a great shop around the corner and look at wallpaper."
"Perfect."
The judge touched the corners of his mouth with a napkin and said, "Associate boot camp is just part of the routine these days, David. You survive that, make partner, and life is good."
"I didn't sign up for the Marines, Dad, and life is never good at a huge law firm like Rogan, because the partners never make enough money."
"I know these partners. I've seen them. For the most part, they're great lawyers and miserable people. I've quit, and I'm not going back. Drop it."
It was the first flash of anger during lunch, and David was disappointed in himself. He drank some mineral water and took a bite of chicken salad. His father smiled, took a bite himself, and chewed for a long time. Helen asked about David's two sisters, and Carolyn jumped at the chance to change the subject. Over dessert, his father asked pleasantly, "What type of work are you doing?"
"Lots of good stuff. This week I prepared a will for a lady who's hiding her assets from her children. They suspect she inherited some money from her third husband, which she did, but they can't seem to find it. She wants to leave everything to her FedEx delivery man.
I represent a gay couple who are trying to adopt a child in Korea.
I have 2 deportation cases involving illegal Mexicans who were caught in a drug ring. I represent the family of a 14-year-old girl who's been hooked on crack for 2 years and there's no place to lock her up for rehab. A couple of drunk driving clients. Sounds like a bunch of riffraff, the judge observed.
No, actually, they're real people with real problems who need help. That's the beauty of street law. You meet the clients face to face. You get to know them, and if things work out, you get to help them.
If you don't starve.
I'm not going to starve, Dad, I promise. Besides, these guys do hit the jackpot every now and then.
I know. I saw them when I was practicing, and I see their cases now on appeal. Last week, we affirmed a $9 million jury verdict, a terrible case involving a brain-damaged kid who got lead poisoning from some toys. His lawyer was a sole practitioner who did a DUI for the mother. He got the case, called in a gunslinger to try it. Now they're splitting 40% of $9 million. Those numbers bounced around the table for a few minutes.
Coffee, anyone? Helen asked.
They all declined and moved to the den. After a few moments, Helen and Carolyn left to inspect the guest room that was about to become a nursery. When they were out of range, the judge mounted his final assault. One of my law clerks came across a story about the Crayox litigation. Saw your picture online, the one from the Tribune, with Mr. Figg. Is he a straight-up guy?
Not really, David admitted.
Doesn't look like.
Let's just say that Wally's complicated.
I'm not sure your career will be advanced if you hang around with these guys.
You could be right, Dad, but for now, I'm having fun.
I look forward to getting to the office. I enjoy my clients, the few that I have, and I am enormously relieved to be out of the sweatshop. Just relax a bit, okay? If this doesn't work out, I'll try something else.
How did you get involved in this Crayox litigation?
We found some cases.
David smiled at the thought of his father's reaction if he told the truth about their search for clients. Wally and his .44 caliber Magnum. Wally offering cash bribes for client referrals. Wally hitting the funeral home circuit.
No, there were things the judge should never know.
Have you researched Crayox? The judge asked.
I'm in the process, have you?
Yes, as a matter of fact. The TV ads are running in Minnesota. The drug is getting a lot of attention. Looks like another mass tort scam to me. Pile on the lawsuits until the drug maker is facing bankruptcy, then broker a huge settlement that makes the lawyers richer and allows the manufacturers to stay in business. Lost in the shuffle is the issue of liability, not to mention what's best for the clients.
That's a pretty fair summary, David admitted.
So you're not sold on the case?
Not yet. I've plowed through 1,000 pages and I'm still looking for the smoking gun. The research to prove that the drug hurts people. I'm not sure it does.
Then why did you put your name on the lawsuit?
David took a deep breath and thought for a moment.
Wally asked me, and since I'm new at the firm, I felt an obligation to join the fun.
Looked at. There are some very powerful lawyers around the country who have filed this same lawsuit and who believe this is a bad drug. Wally does not inspire a lot of confidence, but other lawyers do.
So you're just riding their coattails?
Hanging on for dear life.
Don't get hurt.
The women were back and organizing a shopping trip. David jumped to his feet and claimed to be infatuated with wallpaper. The judge, reluctantly, tagged along. David was almost asleep when Helen rolled over and said,
"Are you awake?"
"I am now. Why?"
"Your parents are funny."
"Yes, and it's time for my parents to go home."
"That case your father mentioned about the little boy and the lead poisoning?"
"Helen, it's 5 minutes after midnight.
The lead came from a toy and it caused brain damage, right?"
"As I recall, yes. Where is this going, dear?"
"There's a lady in one of my classes, Tony, and we had a quick sandwich last week in the student union. She's a few years older, kids in high school, and she has a housekeeper who is from Burma."
"This is fascinating. Can we get some sleep?"
"Just listen. The housekeeper has a grandson, a little boy, who's in the hospital right now with brain damage. He's comatose on a respirator. Things are desperate. The doctors suspect it's lead poisoning, and they've asked the housekeeper to search high and low for lead. One source might be the child's toys."
David sat up in bed and switched on a lamp.
Chapter 16.
Rochelle was at her desk, diligently tracking news of a bed linen sale at a nearby discount house when the call came. A Mr. Jerry Alessandros from Fort Lauderdale wanted to speak with Mr. Wally Figg, who was at his desk. She routed the call through and returned to her online work. Moments later, Wally strutted out of his office with his patented look of self-satisfaction. "Ms. Gibson, could you check flights to Las Vegas this weekend, leaving midday Friday?" "I suppose. Who's going to Las Vegas?" "Well, who else has asked about going to Vegas? Me, that's who. There's an unofficial meeting of Crayox lawyers this weekend at the MGM Grand. That was Jerry Alessandros on the phone. Maybe the biggest mass tort operator in the country. Says I need to be there. Is Oscar in?" "Yes, I think he's awake." Wally tapped on the door as he shoved it open. He slammed it behind himself. "Come right in," Oscar said as he pulled himself away from the paperwork littering his desk. Wally fell into a large leather chair. "Just got a call from Zell and Potter in Fort Lauderdale. They want me in Vegas this weekend for a Crayox strategy meeting, off the record. All the big boys will be there to plan the attack. It's crucial. They'll discuss multi-district litigation, which lawsuit goes first, and most important, settlement. Jerry thinks that Varick might want a quick endgame on this one." Wally was rubbing his hands together as he spoke. "Jerry?" "Alessandros, the legendary tort lawyer. His firm made $1 billion off Fenfen alone." "So you want to go to Las Vegas?" Wally shrugged as if he could take it or leave it. "I don't care anything about going, Oscar, but it's imperative that someone from our firm show up at the table. They might start talking money, settlement, big bucks, Oscar. This thing could be closer than we realize."
"And you want the firm to pay for your trip to Vegas?"
"Sure, it's a legitimate litigation expense."
Oscar ruffled through a pile of papers and found what he wanted. He lifted it and sort of waved it at his junior partner.
"Have you seen David's memo? It came in last night. The one about the projected costs of our Crayox litigation?"
"No, I didn't know he was..."
"The guy's very bright, Wally. He's doing the homework that you should be doing. You need to take a look at this because it's scary as hell. We need at least 3 experts on board now, not next week. In fact, we should have had them lined up before you filed suit. The first expert is a cardiologist who can explain the cause of death of each of our beloved clients. Estimated cost to hire one is $20,000, and that's just for the initial evaluation and deposition. If the cardiologist testifies at trial, add another $20,000. "It's not going to trial. That's what you keep saying. Number 2 is a pharmacologist who can explain to the jury in great detail exactly how the drug killed our clients. What did it do to their hearts? This guy is even pricier. $25,000 initially, and the same if he testifies at trial."
"That sounds high."
"All of it sounds high.
Number 3 is a research scientist who can present to the jury the findings of his study that will show, by a preponderance of the evidence, that statistics prove you're much likelier to suffer heart damage while taking Crayox than some other cholesterol drug."
"I know just the guy."
"Is it McFadden?"
"That's him."
"Great. He wrote the report that started this frenzy, and now he's a bit reluctant to get involved in the litigation. However, if a law firm will fork over an initial retainer of $50,000, he might favor the law firm with a lending hand."
"That's outrageous."
"It's all outrageous. Please look at David's memo, Wally. He summarizes the backlash against McFadden and his work. There are some serious doubts about whether this drug actually causes harm."
"What does David know about litigation?"
"What do we know about litigation, Wally? You're talking to me, your longtime partner, not some prospective client. We bark and growl about hauling bad guys into the courtroom, but you know the truth. We always settle."
"And we're going to settle now, Oscar, trust me. I'll know a whole lot more when I get back from Vegas."
"How much will that cost?"
"Peanuts, in the scope of things."
"We're in over our heads, Wally."
"No, we're not. We'll piggyback with the big boys and make a fortune, Oscar."
Rochelle found a much cheaper room at the Spirit of Rio Motel. The photos on its website were of stunning views of the Vegas Strip, and it was easy to get the impression that its guests were in the thick of things. They were not, as Wally realized when the airport shuttle van finally stopped. The tall, sleek casino hotels were visible, but 15 minutes away. Wally cursed Rochelle as he waited in the sauna-like lobby to check in. A standard room at the MGM Grand was $400 a night. At this dump, it was $125, a 2-night savings that almost covered his airfare. pinching pennies while waiting on a fortune, Wally told himself as he climbed two flights of stairs to his rather small room. He couldn't rent a car because of his DUI conviction and lack of a valid license. He asked around and learned that another shuttle ran from the Spirit of Rio to the Strip every 30 minutes. He played dollar slots in the lobby and won $100. Maybe this was his lucky weekend. The shuttle was packed with overweight retirees. Wally couldn't find a seat, so he stood, clutched the handrails, rocked along in bodily contact with sweaty people, and as he glanced around, he wondered how many might be Crayox victims. High cholesterol was definitely on display. He had business cards in his pockets, as always, but he let it pass. He roamed the casino for a while, watching closely as an astonishing variety of people played blackjack, roulette, and craps, games he'd never played and had no desire to try now. He killed some time at a slot machine and twice said no thanks to a comely cocktail waitress. Wally was beginning to realize that a casino was a lousy place for a recovering drunk. At 7 p.m., he found his way to a banquet room on the mezzanine. Two security guards blocked the door, and Wally was relieved when they found his name on the list. Inside, there were two dozen or so well-dressed men and three women engaged in light chatter over drinks. A buffet dinner was being arranged along a far wall. Some of the lawyers knew each other, but Wally was not the only rookie in the crowd. They all seemed to recognize his name, and they all knew about his lawsuit. Before long, he was beginning to fit in. Jerry Alessandro sought him out, and they shook hands like old friends. Others crowded around, then little pockets of conversation peeled off here and there. They talked about lawsuits, politics, the latest in private jets, homes in the Caribbean, and who was getting divorced and remarried. Wally had little to add, but he gamely hung on and proved to be a good listener. Trial lawyers preferred to do all the talking, and at times they all talked at once. Wally was happy to just grin, listen, and sip his club soda. After a quick dinner, Alessandro stood and began the conversation. The plan was to meet at 9 the following morning in the same room and get down to business. They should be finished by noon. He had spoken several times with Nicholas Walker at Varick, and obviously the company was shell-shocked. In its long and colorful history of litigation, it had never been hit so fast and so hard with so many lawsuits. It was scrambling to get some sense of the damage. According to experts hired by Alessandro's, the potential pool of injured or dead could be as high as 500,000. This news of so much misery and suffering was well received around the table. The potential cost to Varick, according to yet another expert hired by Alessandro's, was at least $5 billion. Wally was fairly certain he was not the only one at the table who did a quick multiplication. 40% of $5 billion. The others, though, seemed to take it all in stride. Another drug, another war with Big Pharma, another massive settlement that would make them even richer. They could buy more jets, more homes, more trophy wives, assets Wally cared nothing for. All he wanted was a chunk in the bank, enough cash to make life enjoyable and free from the daily grind. In a room full of considerable egos, it was only a matter of time before someone else wanted the floor. Dudley Brill from Lubbock, boots and all, plunged into the retelling of a recent conversation with a high-ranking Varick defense lawyer in Houston, who strongly implied that the company had no plans to settle until after the drug's liability was tested before a few juries. Therefore, based on Brill's analysis of a conversation no one else in the room knew about, he was of the firm opinion that he, Dudley Brill of Lubbock, Texas, should lead the first trial, and do so in his hometown, where the jurors had proven they loved him and would fork over huge sums if he asked for them. Brill had obviously been drinking, as had everybody else but Wally, and his self-serving analysis touched off a furious debate around the dinner table. Before long, several skirmishes were underway, with tempers flaring and insults being traded. Jerry Alessandros managed to bring order. "I was hoping we could save all this for tomorrow," he said diplomatically. "Let's retire now, go to our separate corners, and come back tomorrow all sobered up and rested." From the looks of things the following morning, not all of the trial lawyers went to their rooms and to bed. Puffy eyes, red eyes, hands grabbing cold water and coffee. The signs were there. There was no shortage of hangovers. There were not as many lawyers either, and as the morning dragged on, Wally began to realize a lot of business had been conducted over drinks late the night before. Deals had been cut, alliances forged, backstabbed. Wally wondered where he stood. Two experts talked about Crayox in the most recent studies. Each lawyer spent a few minutes talking about his or her lawsuit, number of clients, number of potential client deaths versus injuries, judges, opposing counsel, and verdict trends in the jurisdiction. Wally winged it nicely and said as little as possible. An incredibly boring expert dissected the financial health of Varick Labs and deemed the company fit enough to sustain huge losses from a Crayox settlement. The word settlement was used frequently and was always ringing in Wally's ears. The same expert became even more tedious when analyzing the various insurance coverages Varick had in force. After 2 hours, Wally needed a break. He eased out and went to find a restroom. When he returned, Jerry Alessandros was waiting outside the door.
"When are you headed back to Chicago?" he asked.
"In the morning," Wally replied.
"Flying commercial?"
"Of course," Wally thought. "I do not have my own jet, so like most poor Americans, I'm forced to pay for a ticket on a jet owned by someone else."
"Sure," he said with a smile. "Look, Wally, I'm headed to New York this afternoon. Why don't you hitch a ride? My firm just bought a brand new Gulfstream G650. We'll have lunch on the plane and drop you off in Chicago."
There would be a price to pay, a deal to be cut, but Wally was looking for one anyway. He had read about rich trial lawyers and their private jets, but it had never crossed his mind that he would see the inside of one.
"That's very generous," he said. "Sure. Meet me in the lobby at 1 p.m., okay?"
"You got it." There were a dozen or so private jets lined up on the deck at McCarran Field's General Aviation Center. As Wally followed his new pal Jerry past them, he wondered how many were owned by the other Mass Tort boys. When they got to Jerry's, he climbed the steps, took a breath, then stepped inside the gleaming G650. A striking Asian girl took his coat and asked what he wanted to drink.
"Just club soda."
Jerry Alessandros had a small entourage with him, an associate, two paralegals, and an assistant of some kind. They huddled briefly in the rear of the cabin as Wally settled into the rich leather seat and thought about Iris Klopek and Millie Marino and those wonderful widows whose dead husbands had led Wally into the world of mass torts, and now to this. The flight attendant handed Wally a menu. Down the aisle, far away, he could see a kitchen with a chef just waiting. As they taxied, Jerry made his way to the front and sat down opposite Wally.
"What do you think?" he asked, raising his hands to take in his latest toy.
"Sure beats commercial," Wally said. Jerry howled with laughter, no doubt the funniest thing he'd ever heard. A voice announced takeoff, and they all buckled their seatbelts. As the jet left the runway and shot upward, Wally closed his eyes and tried to savor the moment. It might never happen again. As soon as they began to level off, Jerry came to life. He popped a switch and pulled a mahogany table out of the wall.
"Let's talk business," he said.
"It's your plane," Wally thought.
"Sure.
How many cases do you realistically expect to sign up?"
We might get 10 death cases. We have 8 now. Non-death, I'm not sure. We have a pool of several hundred potential cases, but we haven't screened them yet."
Jerry frowned as if this weren't enough, not worth his time. Wally wondered if he might order the pilot to turn around or open a hatch somewhere.
"Have you thought about teaming up with a bigger firm?" Jerry asked. "I know you guys don't do a lot of mass tort work."
"Sure, I'm open to that discussion," Wally replied, trying to conceal his excitement. That had been his plan since the beginning. "My contracts provide for a contingency fee of 40%. How much do you want?"
"In our typical deal, we front the expenses, and these are not cheap cases. We find the doctors, experts, researchers, whomever, and they cost a fortune. We take half the fee, 20%, but the expenses are paid back to us before any split of the fee."
"That sounds fair. What's our role in this?"
"Simple. Find more cases, death and non-death. Round them up. I'll send a draft of an agreement on Monday. I'm trying to piece together as many cases as possible.
The next big step is the creation of an MDL, multi-district litigation. The court will appoint a plaintiff's trial committee, usually 5 or 6 seasoned lawyers who will control the litigation. That panel is entitled to an additional fee, usually around 6%, and this comes off the top and out of the lawyer's portion." Wally was nodding along. He'd done some research and knew the ins and outs, most of them.
"Will you be on the trial committee?" he asked.
"Probably, I usually am." The flight attendant brought fresh drinks. Jerry took a sip of wine and continued.
When discovery starts, we'll send someone to help with the depositions of your clients. No big deal. Pretty routine legal work. Keep in mind, Wally, that the defense firms see this as a gold mine, too, so they work the cases hard. I'll find a cardiologist we can trust, one who'll screen your clients for damage. We'll pay him out of the litigation fund. Any questions?
Not now, Wally said. He was not pleased to be giving away half the fee, but he was delighted to be in business with an experienced and deep-pocketed tort firm. There would still be plenty of money for Finley and Fig. He thought of Oscar and couldn't wait to tell him about the G650.
"What's your best guess for the timeline?" Wally asked. In other words, when can I expect some money? A long, satisfying pull of the wine, and based on my experience, which, as you know, Wally, is quite vast, I expect we'll reach a settlement in 12 months and start disbursing money right away. Who knows, Wally? In a year or so, you might have your own airplane.
Chapter 17. Nicholas Walker flew with Judy Beck and two other Varick lawyers to Chicago on one of the company's corporate jets, a Gulfstream G650 that was just as new as the one that had so thoroughly impressed Wally. The purpose of their trip was to fire their old law firm and hire a new one. Walker and his boss, Reuben Massey, had hammered out the details of a master plan to deal with their Crayox mess, and the first major battle would take place in Chicago. First, though, they had to get the right people in place. The wrong people belonged to a firm that had represented Varick Labs for a decade, and their work had always been considered top-notch. Their shortcoming was not their fault. According to the exhaustive research done by Walker and his team, there was another firm in the city with closer ties to Judge Harry Seawright, and this firm happened to have a partner who was the hottest defense lawyer in town. Her name was Nadine Karras, a 44-year-old litigation partner who had not lost a jury trial in 10 years. The more she won, the more difficult her cases became, and the more impressive her victories. After chatting with dozens of attorneys who had faced her in court and lost, Nick Walker and Reuben Massey decided that Ms. Karras would lead the defense of Crayox, and they didn't care what it would eventually cost. First, though, they had to convince her. During a long teleconference, she had seemed ambivalent about taking charge of a major case that was expanding daily. Not surprisingly, she already had too much work on her desk. Her trial calendar was booked, and so on. She had never been involved in a mass tort case, though as a pure litigator, this was not much of an obstacle. Walker and Massey knew her recent string of courtroom wins included a wide range of issues: groundwater contamination, hospital negligence, the mid-air collision of two commuter planes. As an elite courtroom advocate, Nadine Karras could handle any case before any jury. She was a partner in the litigation section of Rogan Rothberg on the 85th floor of the Trust Tower, with a corner office with a view of the lake, though she seldom enjoyed it. She met the Varick crew in a large conference room on the 86th floor, and after everyone had a quick gawk at Lake Michigan, they settled in for what was expected to be a two-hour meeting, minimum. On her side of the table, Ms. Karras had the usual complement of young associates and paralegals, a veritable entourage of grim-faced minions ready to say, "How high?" when she said, "Jump." To her right was a male litigation partner named Hotchkin, her right-hand man. Later, in a phone call to Reuben Massey, Nicholas Walker would report, "She's very attractive, Reuben. Long, dark hair, strong chin and teeth, beautiful hazel eyes that are so warm and inviting, you think this is the woman I want to take home to meet Mama. A very pleasant personality, quick with a nice smile. A deep, rich voice like one you'd expect from an opera singer. Easy to see why jurors are so taken with her, but she's tough. No doubt about that, Reuben. She takes charge and gives orders, and you get the impression that those around her are fiercely loyal. I'd hate to face this woman in court, Reuben." "So she's the one?" Reuben asked. "No question. I found myself looking forward to the trial just to watch her in action." "Legs?" "Oh, yes, the package. Slender, dressed like something out of a magazine. You should meet her as soon as possible." It was her turf, so Ms. Karras quickly assumed control of the meeting. She nodded to Hotchkin and said, "Mr. Hotchkin and I presented your proposal to our fee committee. My rate will be $1,000 an hour out of court, $2,000 in court, with an initial retainer of $5 million, non-refundable, of course." Nicholas Walker had been negotiating fees with elite lawyers for two decades,
and he was shockproof. "And how much for the other partners?" he asked calmly, as if his company could handle anything she threw at them, which, in fact, it could.
$800 an hour, $500 for associates," she replied.
"Agreed," he said. Everyone in the room knew the cost of defense would run into the millions. In fact, Walker and his team had already pegged their initial estimate at $25 to $30 million. Peanuts when you're getting sued for billions. With the air clear on what it would cost, they moved on to the next important matter. Nicholas Walker had the floor.
"Our strategy is simple, and it's complicated," he began.
"Simple in that we pick a case from the myriad of those filed against us, an individual case, not a class action, and we push hard for a trial. We want a trial. We are not afraid of a trial because we believe in our drug. We believe, and we can prove, that the research being relied upon by the tort boys is deeply flawed. We are convinced that Crayox does what it is supposed to do, and it does not increase the risks of heart attack or stroke. We are certain of this, so certain that we want a jury, one right here in Chicago, to hear our evidence, and soon. We are confident the jury will believe us, and when the jury rejects the attack on Crayox, when the jury finds in our favor, the battlefield will change dramatically. Frankly, we think the tort bar will scatter like leaves in the wind. They'll cave. It might take another trial, another victory, but I doubt it. In short, Ms. Karras, we hit them hard and fast with a jury trial, and when we win, they'll go home." She listened without taking notes. When he finished, she said, "Indeed, that's pretty simple and not altogether original. Why Chicago?"
"The judge, Harry Seawright. We've researched every judge in every Crayox case filed so far, and we think Seawright is our man. He's shown little patience for mass torts. He despises frivolous lawsuits and junk filings. He uses his rocket docket to ram cases through discovery and get them to trial. He refuses to allow cases to gather dust. His favorite nephew uses Crayox, and, most important, his close friend is former U.S. Senator Paxson, who now has an office on, I believe, the 83rd floor here at Rogan Rothberg.
Are you suggesting we could somehow influence a federal judge?" she asked, with her left eyebrow slightly arched.
"Of course not," Walker said with a nasty grin.
"What's the complicated part of your plan?"
"Deception. We create the impression that we intend to settle the Crayox cases. We've been down this road before, believe me, so we know quite a lot about mass settlements. We understand the greed of the tort bar, and it is enormous beyond imagination. Once they believe that billions are about to hit the table, the frenzy will get much worse. With a settlement looming, the preparation for a major trial will become less important. Why bother to prepare when the cases are about to settle? We, you, on the other hand, are working diligently to get ready for the trial. In our scheme, Judge Seawright will crack the whip, and the case will move along quickly. At the perfect moment, the settlement negotiations will collapse, the mass tort bar will be in chaos, and we'll be staring at a trial date that Seawright will refuse to move." Nadine Karras was nodding, smiling, enjoying the scenario.
"I'm sure you have a case in mind," she said.
"Oh, yes. There's a local divorce lawyer named Wally Figg who filed the first Crayox case here in Chicago. Not much of a lawyer. Three-man firm, nickel-and-dime stuff down on the southwest side. Almost zero trial experience and absolutely none in the mass tort arena. Now he's hooked up with a lawyer in Fort Lauderdale named Jerry Alessandros, a longtime nemesis whose goal in life is to sue Varick at least once a year. Alessandros is a force."
"Can he try a case?" Nadine asked, already thinking about the trial.
"His firm is Zell and Potter, and they have some competent trial lawyers, but they rarely go to trial. Their specialty is forcing companies to settle and raking in enormous fees. At this point, we have no idea who would show up here and actually handle the trial. They might bring in a local lawyer."
To Walker's left, Judy Beck cleared her throat and began, somewhat nervously,
"Alessandros has already filed a motion to consolidate every Crayox case into an MDL, multi-district litigation, and..."
"We understand MDL," Hodgkin broke in sharply.
"Of course. Alessandros has a favorite federal judge in southern Florida, and his M.O. is to create the MDL, get himself appointed to the plaintiff's steering committee, then control the litigation. He, of course, receives extra compensation for being on the committee." Nick Walker took up the narrative. Initially, we would resist all efforts to consolidate the cases. Our plan is to select one of Mr. Figg's clients and convince Judge Seawright to assign it to his rocket docket. What if the judge in Florida orders consolidation of all cases and wants them down there? Hodgkin asked. Judge Seawright is a federal judge, Walker said. The case has been filed in his court. If he wants to try it here, no one, not even the Supreme Court, can order him to do otherwise.
Nadine Karras was scanning a summary that had been passed around by the Varick team. She said, "So if I follow things, we select one of Mr. Figg's dead clients and we convince Judge Seawright to extract this case from the group. Then, assuming the judge goes along, we respond rather softly to the lawsuit, admit nothing, issue bland denials, take an easy approach to discovery because we don't want to slow things down, take a few depositions, give them whatever documents they want, and sort of lead them down the primrose path until they wake up and realize they have a real trial on their hands. Meanwhile, you lull them into a false sense of security with the illusion of another jackpot."
"That's it," Nick Walker said.
"Exactly."
They spent almost an hour discussing Mr. Figg's dead clients: Chester Marino, Percy Klopek, Wanda Grand, Frank Schmidt, and four others. As soon as the lawsuit was properly answered, Ms. Karras and her team would depose the legal representatives of the dead eight. Once they had the opportunity to observe and learn, they would make the decision about which one to isolate and push toward a trial. The matter of young David Zink was dealt with quickly. Though he had worked at Rogan Rothberg for 5 years, he was no longer employed there. No conflict of interest existed because at the time the firm did not represent Varick and Zink did not represent the dead clients. Nadine Karras had never met him. Indeed, only one associate on her side of the table could recall ever knowing who he was. Zink had worked in international finance, a world away from litigation. Zink was now working in the world of street law and happy to be even further away from international finance. Very much on his mind these days was the Burmese housekeeper and her lead-poisoned grandson. He had a name, a phone number, and an address, but making contact had proved difficult. Tony, Helen's friend, had suggested to the grandmother that the family consult a lawyer, but this had terrified the poor woman to the point of tears. She was emotionally spent, confused, and for the moment, unapproachable. Her grandson remained on life support. David had contemplated running the case by his two partners, but quickly thought better of it. Wally might go charging into the hospital room and frighten someone to death. Oscar might insist on taking charge of the case and then want an extra percentage in the event of a settlement. As David was learning, his two partners did not split money equally and, according to Rochelle, fought over fees. Points were given for the lawyer who made initial contact, more for the lawyer who worked up the file, and so on. According to Rochelle, on almost every decent car wreck, Oscar and Wally quibbled over the split. David was at his desk drafting a simple will for a new client, typing it himself because Rochelle had informed him weeks